Previously on Beta.
Hello, all you happy people. You know what? I'm the hero.
He just played me this bass line one day. Whoa. Oh, my goodness. It was sort of snaky and sinuous and just grabbed me.
Let's do some improvisational comedy. No.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, author Sam Wasson tells us how America invented improv and shares the principles of its most prodigious practitioners, including trailblazing teacher Del Close.
I think Del's great lesson to the world is take the crazy choice, make the crazy choice, because it's only on the other side of crazy that you're going to find new worlds.
Also, Joey, Johnny, Dee Dee, Tommy, author Donna Gaines on why the legendary punk rock band The Ramones matter.
They told the outcast and the outsider, hey, you matter, you're welcome, gobba gobba, we accept you, one of us. What more does anyone want out of religion, out of family, out of community?
But first, John Moe. Chances are pretty good that you're familiar with John Moe. He's had a long, illustrious career in public radio. He's hosted nationally distributed programs such as WITS, Weekend America, and Marketplace Tech. He's also the creator and host of the award-winning podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression. The podcast featured frank and powerful conversations with luminaries that covered all facets of depression and helped generate much-needed awareness. John has now written a companion book to the series called, wait for it, The Hilarious World of Depression. In it, he reveals his own personal struggles with the disorder.
I went through many decades just kind of getting by and putting up the front and fooling people and fooling myself. It was in my mid-30s when, owned a house, had a couple of kids, was married. My particular strain of depression really responds to stress. And as long as there isn't a lot of stress, it was sort of okay. But then, I had a career, I had a mortgage, I had a family, and I just started to kind of crack up a little bit. And my wife said, hey, I want you to go to the doctor because I think this might be a mental health thing. And I said, well, no, I can't, I'm not going to do that. I'm just, things are just are stressful right now. And she said, well, you've been saying that for a couple of years, and I think something's wrong. And why I didn't want to go, this will make no sense to people who haven't had depression and all the sense in the world to people who have. I didn't want to waste the doctor's time. I didn't want them to bother with me, even though that's why doctors exist, is to hear what's wrong with people. And I also didn't want to make the copay, which at the time was $10. I didn't think I was worth 10 bucks. And she said, well, fine, you don't love yourself enough to do this. Do you love me and the kids? And I said, yeah, more than anything. And she said, okay, great, go do it for us. So I did, and I was diagnosed almost instantly, and it really changed my life.
Mm-hmm. What is it about us saddies that you think the normies, the people who don't have to deal with depression, what is it that they have the most trouble understanding?
That it's not a mood. I mean, depression is a word to describe a mood, but depression in the disorder sense is not a mood. I have a friend who lost her neighbor to suicide, and she said, well, I don't understand it because I talked to him 2 days before and he seemed to be doing fine. And I'm like, yeah, because it's not like Morrissey. It's not like you're not moping. It's a mind that's out of whack. And so to that extent, it's not something you can cheer up from. But just like it's not a mood, you can't snap out of it, as my father used to say. And you can't go for a walk and then feel better. You can't smile more. You can't think of all the good things in your life. Because if that's all it took, we would have done that. Like, that's what's so aggravating about the normies is they'll say, well, why don't you just do this? Like, you think I haven't thought of that? It's no more effective than saying, just go for a walk and your leukemia will feel better. It's an illness.
Yeah. You say that even when you're in the darkest and most despairing times of your depression, you still find depression funny. What is it about depression that you find funny?
Well, I mean, I've been a comedy geek since I could understand words. I've always loved comedy in a really deeply connected way. So in one sense, it's just my way of understanding the world is to look for what's funny about it. But even when I'm at my worst, I see it as this sort of naughty, transgressive entity that is just, it's like a toddler behind the wheel of a car. It's a world out of balance. It's, you know, the toddler is in tremendous danger and you should get him out of there. But it's funny. It's funny that it's this invisible thing in your mind that exists to tear you down. That it's such an unmotivated cruelty that it sort of makes me laugh.
You worked at Amazon during its early days. Did working there affect your depression?
Working there kind of helped me discover that something was truly wrong. We were all inventing our jobs at the time, and it was confusing, and there was a lot of power plays, and there was a lot of politics, and you know, there was bets on the future involved. I was there in the late 90s and very early 2000s. And so when I had massive deadlines approaching with a lot on the line, and I didn't have the tools to do my job because I was too busy figuring out what it was, that was one of my first instances of suicidal ideation, which was really surprising when it happened. I was on these tight deadlines. I was on the bus, I remember, through downtown Seattle. I lived in Seattle at the time. And I was thinking of all that I had to do. And this was before smartphones and smart tablets. So all I could do was sit on the bus and think about what I had to do. I couldn't do any of it. And I thought, well, why don't I just die? Why don't I just kill myself? That'll solve it. And it was such a out of the blue idea that I laughed at. I physically laughed out loud on the bus because I didn't want to do that. But it was like, oh, that's a thing. It was related to my stress peaking, which was cueing my depression to kick in. And it led to that thought. It wasn't that I was making a plan. It wasn't that I was in any danger, but there was like some wall that broke through and I'm like, oh no, well, I guess now that's on the table. It was terrifying. I left in 2001 for public radio where all my problems would be solved.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. As have all of mine been solved. Sure. Too, yeah. One of the toughest, if not the toughest things you've ever had to deal with in your life was the death of your older brother, Rick. Can you tell me about that?
Rick was my older brother by 6 years, and he had what would probably now be known as ADHD and dyslexia, and what was known then as being a bad kid or being a dumb kid. And that's what he was told, and that's what he believed. And he couldn't get along with school, you know, started working at 15, 16 years old, and school tapered off after that, and drugs tapered up, and he was a drug addict, moving from pot up to methamphetamine. And so it was, life was really hard for him. And there was a lot of depression that he didn't identify as depression. He thought, again, he was being dumb and bad and making bad decisions and was weak, when in fact he had an illness that nobody would ever choose. So he was in San Diego and he had cleaned up evidently and had been clean for several years and was working at a Narcotics Anonymous hotline. And at that hotline, he was convincing people that life was worth living and that they should stick around. He could never seem to believe that about himself. He went to a shooting range in San Diego, got a gun and shot himself. And so my life was before that happened and after that happened were the two parts of my life, really. That kind of got me going down this whole path to try to help other people not meet the same fate.
Yeah, well, and you experienced a lot of guilt over Rick's suicide. Why?
Well, I had written a book that came out in 2006, in the fall of 2006, and part of the book, I go to a shooting range outside Seattle, and I thought it was so funny that when I called them, they said, okay, well, you need to bring a friend. And I said, well, why is that? You either need to be a member here or you need to bring a friend, because people would just come down here, check out a gun and die right there at the shooting range. I thought that was just such a loose safeguard. Like, okay, well, then you become a member and then you come back. It was sort of more about how the looseness of gun control in America. And so that came out in October. Rick read the book around the holidays, joined a shooting range in February, and died in April of 2007. I have to choose my words carefully. I didn't kill him. He pulled the trigger himself. But I've always felt that I gave him a roadmap to it and a plan. It's something that if some other random reader had done the same thing, I'd be like, oh, that's terrible. They must have been in a really bad place. But because it was my brother, I knew that it was my fault that he died. And I've been to therapy treatments specifically aimed at that belief, and I'm doing pretty well. There's always going to be part of my brain that knows that I'm responsible for his death. And it's smaller than the part that says, of course I'm not, but it's always going to be there.
So it's been 13 years since Rick died. How are you doing in terms of coming to terms with his death?
Because my wife was very diligent, she identified a therapist right away who specializes in survivors of suicide. And that helped me tremendously, that somebody had that specific knowledge and I got to them. It helped me a lot. And the thing about grief is you don't get over it. You go through it. And you're never the same. If you put it off and you try to just do other things instead, it'll just wait for you. It's been a long walk through it. You know, the big thing I did, though, was at Rick's service in Seattle, all these family friends whose services he should have gone to one day were there, and they were coming up and consoling me in hushed tones and talking about how great Rick was on the camping trips that they remember him on when we were kids, and how he would tell a joke and you wouldn't even realize it was a joke for another hour. And, you know, he's always playing pranks that were harmless, but really intricate. And I said, well, yeah, that is what he was like when he was 11 or 12. But he became an addict after that. And he experienced homelessness. And he fought really hard against mental illnesses we didn't know he had. And he got treatment. And he was helping other people. There was a lot to Rick. And he didn't think he was worth saving. And he died because of it. And it's horrible. At that point, the family friend would say, okay, well, it was great seeing you. I'm going to go talk to anyone else right now. And it occurred to me just in that moment, I know the spot on the floor at the church where I had this thought of like, okay, let me get this straight. We could talk about it. You know, we could open up about mental illness, make it no different than saying I have a toothache or my back hurts and go get treatment. And talk to therapists or family or general practitioners or clergy or support group, anybody. We could have more conversations, and there's a very good chance it'll get better for some people. Or we could have no conversations, and there's every likelihood it'll get worse. So what the hell are we doing? How is that even a choice? Why are we choosing as a society the one that kills people? That's stupid. And I had been in radio for a while at that point, and I thought, well, I talk. I have access to microphones. I can put a sentence together. Fine. I'll be the loudmouth. I'll defy my Norwegian upbringing and my suburban childhood. I'll just yell about it. I'll tell everybody about Rick and about myself and about, you know, I'll encourage people to talk to me about what's going on with them. And it's too late for Rick, but maybe it's not too late for somebody else. So I already know how to be a loudmouth. I'll just keep doing it.
And that was the whole motivation behind starting your podcast, The Hilarious World of Depression, in 2016, right?
Yeah, some years later. I mean, I had been mostly a comedy guy. Even my attempts at straight reporting for a variety of public radio shows, there's always a bit of a comic bent to it. And so I've always kind of understood that world. But when I would write about depression, when I'd write about suicide and mental health awareness, even on Twitter, I would get these amazing responses. People saying, that does it. I'm going to make an appointment. I'm going to keep it this time. And I'm going to get help. Or, you know, I heard what you tweeted a month ago. I just came from my second session with my therapist and it's going great. And I'm like, oh my gosh, the power of some tweets. And so I knew that I could talk on the subject, sure, but beyond that there was a hunger to talk about it, that people were like were ready for this movement to occur.
I'm Jeff Tweedy from the rock band Wilco.
I've read a lot about the migraines that you used to get.
I think that migraines were a way of making psychic pain visible. Hmm. The people around me that weren't able to see that there was real psychic pain. People that don't really experience it as a disorder tend to think, well, why can't you just not be sad, right?
Yeah.
So I think that throwing up 30 times in a row and being obviously in enormous pain.
So you felt like your body was converting all this psychic pain into an actual
something
migraine.
That would be nurtured.
Yeah.
As opposed to being reacted to with, I'll give you something to cry about.
Right.
What is the most surprising thing you learned about your decades-long battle with depression while you were writing your book?
I think a lot of things have reasons, and that's vague, but what happened was I was a couple seasons into the show when I agreed to write the book, and I was really hesitant to write the book because I thought, well, who am I? Who cares what my experiences have been? My literary agent said, I think your story can help people, which was the button to push. And I said, okay, fine. And then there was a lot of people interested in publishing it, and it was great. In writing about that subject, I thought, well, if I'm going to write this subject, me, I better learn more about it. If you're going to write a book on something, you better be an expert. So I finally got to some good therapy. So I found a good therapist who specializes in cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the therapy I use that I was really drawn to. And a lot of what that does is explores the cognitive distortions that depression and trauma create. So like thinking that, like magical thinking, where you think, well, it was a sunny day when I have to confront this thing, so this is going to go well. Or like, I'm nervous about what's going to happen and it's all going to fail because everything's always going to fail. And then when it doesn't fail, you don't think about that. You just think, oh, it's always going to fail. And these are all unrealistic, unverified, unscientific, and defenseless ways of looking at the world. And so what the therapy I went to really explored was, okay, why is this happening and how can we redirect it to more sensible, more workable thought patterns that are more in touch with the real world? And one of the ways that they do that is saying, okay, what are the things that are causing you agitation and where do these things come from? It's about knowing where you are and how you got there. I sometimes compare it to the difference between having a map of where you are, where you've come from, where you're going versus just constantly waking up behind the wheel and trying to get somewhere.
John Moe, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Doug.
John Moe is the author of The Hilarious World of Depression and the host and creator of the podcast of the same name. Find out more about John and his work at wpr.org/beta.
They matter politically because they gave people the ability to critique the mainstream without having to go through college.
Sociologist Donna Gaines joins us to talk about her book, Why the Ramones Matter. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
People asking questions, lost in confusion.
This is Rock and Roll Radio. Come on, let's rock and roll with the Ramones.
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and this is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The Ramones are considered by many to be the first true punk rock group. The band formed in the Forest Hill, Queens neighborhood in New York City. Joey, Johnny, Dee Dee, and Tommy all adopted the last name Ramone. It was an homage to Paul McCartney, who checked into hotels under the name Paul Ramone. We're still waiting to hear back from Paul Ramone to find out if he ever checked into hotels under the name Paul McCartney. Donna Gaines is a sociologist, journalist, and social worker from the Forest Hill area. Needless to say, she is a big Ramones fan. So she's written the biography of the group with Why the Ramones Matter.
This story goes back a long time. I met them formally in 1996, and by then the venomous relationship of what has been known as punk's most dysfunctional family was very well known to journalists, but also to the fans. They really didn't get along. There was a lot of infighting. All of that was known, but then when I became friends with them, you get to the inside of that, and it was just nonstop. But like every family, they banded together to do what they did best, which was give us the Ramones.
Mm. You say that every Ramones song over the years has been for you. What do you mean?
Well, it's just something that really speaks to your soul, and you recognize yourself in it, and other people recognize themselves in it, and then when you meet them, you recognize it in each other. So it's creating a community. But in the very beginning, when they're writing a song about Carbona, not glue, when I was in high school, and I am exactly Joey's age, the age he would be today, That's what we were doing, Carbona and glue. And that was what people recreationally were involved in. It was cheap, and we were stupid. I don't recommend anyone doing it, ever. But things like, I just want to have something to do. So much of teenage life is about teenage kicks and teenage boredom.
Yeah.
And teenage superfluousness.
Yeah. And then there's the Rockaway Beach connection. That's one of their biggest songs, probably. I think it is their highest charting original song of their career. And what is the connection to you for Rockaway Beach?
Oh, well, I grew up there.
Yeah.
And so just for Dee Dee, who really personifies the spirit of Rockaway Beach, as do the Ramones in general, it's just celebrating our homeland, which is a surf town. We like to say it was a drinking town with a surf problem.
Rock, rock, rock away, beach. Rock, rock, rock away, beach. Rock, rock, rock away, beach. We get into rock to rock away, beach. Rock,
and generations of real scrappy DIY type outlaws.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the idea that people came from nearby communities in Queens, they came from Forest Hills.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they hitchhiked out, and there were girls to be flirted with, and there was pinball to play with, and, you know, all sorts of savory substances to acquire.
Yeah.
And so they really grasped Queens' indigenous culture of a particular generation at a particular moment in history, in the 70s, as, you know, the worms started turning on the American dream.
Do you consider the Ramones to be the first punk rock band?
Oh, hell yes.
Yeah? Why? Why?
Because I think they invented the genre. They put it out. Let me just back up from a musicology point of view and say that there were garage bands early on and strains of punk, you know, in Iggy Pop's music and this just stuff, Iggy and the Stooges, Wayne Kramer, MC5, all could be considered punk. But the Ramones really sealed it in blood with this first album, demoting the role of guitar solos, advancing the idea that it was democratically available to any person to create their own music and to have a band. There were just a lot of things that they brought to the table, the 3-minute songs, and then the way they distilled their message and their attitude above all things, that you didn't have to be beautiful, rich, be a maestro guitarist, have tons of corporate backing, that it really belonged to the kids.
It seems to me that Joey's voice might have been the band's secret weapon, the USP, unique selling proposition. He was actually singing, unlike the vocalist in a lot of other punk rock bands. Would you agree that Joey's voice is part of what made the Ramones stand out?
Oh, absolutely. He was no screamer. Mm-hmm. He wasn't a screecher. He used his voice as what it is, which is a musical instrument, and he worked at it. He took voice lessons. It was different. It was very different than, say, screaming Sex Pistols. And of course, we love them too.
Mm-hmm. Joey and Dee Dee wrote most of the songs for the band. What was the difference between their songs?
That's such a great question. Dee Dee, to me, was speed pop. He was bizarro. He was a genius. He was absolutely original. And the songs were funny. They were critical. They were very radical. Joey's songs had more of a romantic edge to them. Joey was more open musically than most people would even know. And so Joey added a little romance to it. The combination of the two gave you a lot of variety, and it included a lot of people, angry people and lonely people.
Yeah. A couple of years after the Ramones retired and a long time after Dee Dee had quit the band, you ran into him on the Lower East Side, and he told you that he didn't feel like he fit in anywhere. How did you react when he told you that?
On the one hand, it was heartbreaking. On the other hand, it was the most validating thing he could have ever said. And I remember we were standing in a club where he was a king bee, and he was with his beautiful wife, Barbara Zampini, who was herself a musician. Anybody that would have walked by would have just been, wow, that's Dee Dee. And he's standing there in the city that he built, basically downtown punk New York, and he's saying, like, I just don't fit in anywhere. And I looked at him and I said, Dee Dee, you don't have to. We fit in with you. When you look at what the Ramones were all about, their ministry being to draw the outcast in from the margins, and this is something that comes up in every one of their stories, that they were outcasts, they were deviant kids, and they were people who felt they didn't belong and they weren't wanted. And they created this safe space for people who felt the same way and still do. I think one of my favorite songs is I'm an Outsider, which I think I play it every day. It just makes me really feel like, wow, if I am, then I'm not alone.
What is your all-time favorite Ramones song?
It's going to have to be Commando. Johnny's song!
Yeah, and it's the title of his autobiography. What is it about it that you love so much?
Well, I'm trained as a sociologist. So rules, the rules. I love the rules. And the fact that there's some embedded wisdom in them, but also they're ridiculous.
In his autobiography of the same name, Commando, the name of Donna Gaines' favorite Ramones song, Johnny Ramone said that the Ramones' mission was to save rock and roll. Do you think the band accomplished
this? Oh, yeah. Well, they did. They restored it to the kids. They seized the airwaves. Think about the bands that came after them. Think about college radio. Think about the alternative music scene. Think about, like, all the subcultures from queercore to afropunk to Foxcore, think about Courtney Love, think about Cobain, and so much, the hardcore scene, speed metal, and how much they influenced everything, including just like our worldview.
That's interesting, what the last thing you said there about how the Ramones influenced our worldview. Can you just talk briefly about that? How did they do
well,
that?
Well, the DIY, do-it-yourself ethic that permeates their approach to creating culture is grounded in our dad's post-war. It's a working class economic arrangement where you draw from the original natural resources available to you, which may not be much, and out of that you create your culture. And by giving young people access to that knowledge, hey, listen to our first album, you can set up a home studio, you can record your own music. You don't have to be gorgeous. You don't have to really be a great songwriter. You don't even have to know how to play music or read music. You just have to work really hard. So it created a local to global social movement, really a cultural movement, that to this day empowers young people to create their own. That's huge.
Yeah, very well said. So final question, why do the Ramones matter?
They matter politically because they gave people the ability to critique the mainstream without having to go through college, which many people may not have been doing, to learn critical thinking and critical theory. They gave people this alternative economic base in DIY, which allowed them to create their own music. They told the outcast and the outsider, hey, you matter, you're welcome, gabba gabba, we accept you, one of us.
Yeah.
What more does anyone want out of religion, out of family, out of community? And they gave that to people in music, in brilliant music. Why did they matter? Because they're the effing Ramones.
Thank you. Yeah. Donna Gaines, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Donna Gaines is the author of Why the Ramones Matter. You can find out more about Donna and the Ramones at WPR.org/beta.
Because SETV is about media satire and show business satire, that extended into the visual presentation.
Author Sam Wasson tells us how the Canadian TV show Second City Television contributed to the creation of the great American art form of improv. That's coming up in just a moment. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. This is Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. The history of improv is an important part of comedy in America. Without improv, comedy would not be nearly as inventive, nor nearly as funny. While ad-libbing has been around for a while, the art form of improv is a wholly American invention. That's the case author Sam Wasson makes in his book, Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art. Sam joined Beta recently to talk about his book about the great film noir Chinatown. When I sprang the idea on him to spontaneously talk about the history of improv, Sam was more than game. So if you're wondering why this conversation has more of a freewheeling, spontaneous kind of flow to it than other Beta conversations, it's because we improvised it. Maybe we should do all our interviews this way. Or maybe not. Anyway, here's Sam Wasson on the history of improv comedy.
Improvisation was invented in this country. People assume improv has been around, you know, since the beginning of time. Ad-libbing has been around. Certainly people have, you know, had scripts and have deviated from the scripts. But the whole notion of, can I get a suggestion from the audience, that was invented by Viola Spolin in Chicago in the early part of the 20th century. And she was a social worker and invented these improvisational games as a way to get children to interact with each other, children who didn't speak the same language, children who were anxious to interact. And so Viola created these games. And it really was a therapy and a political therapy for children. So it was an invented art form.
Yeah. And my wife, Catherine, I'm going to do my impression of her for you. She's, because when I told her, talked to her about your book, she said, improv wasn't invented in America. It was done in England and France before that.
No, not true.
Not true. There
in
you
fact,
go.
I mean, yes. It was illegal, actually, in England because...
That's what I meant to tell her. Yes, and yes. Yeah, it was illegal. They had to run the script by the Lord Chamberlain, right?
You got it.
Yeah, exactly. You got it. Okay, so so you mentioned Viola, kind of the grandmother or the mother of improv, and then her son, Paul Sills, kind of carried the torch in terms of spreading the word about improv. And then we go to Chicago... Right, and Compass, isn't that a key?
This is all in Chicago. Viola starts in Chicago.
Yes.
Her son Paul takes his mother's games for children, and he says, well, what if adults play these games on stage?
Yeah.
And that could be a great way to convey, you know, the news of the day, to create instant theater for people and show people what their lives look like right now. And he cast two University of Chicago students. Well, I should say one of them was not enrolled, but just hanging out. And they were Mike Nichols and Elaine May.
Yes.
So at that point, improv comedy becomes invented accidentally. This was not work that was intended to be funny. That's why I'm stressing the difference between improvisation and improv comedy. Improv comedy starts when Sills casts Mike and Elaine, whose natural pose is just to be funny.
Yeah. Yeah. Tell me about, like, what are your favorite, one of the iconic Mike and Elaine sketches, yes.
There's a sketch called Teenagers, which is basically two teenagers trying to make out on a park bench. There's also the mother sketch, which is the Jewish mother, you know, giving her son a hard time for being out of touch. And he's, of course, a rocket scientist, so he's been a little busy.
You know, Arthur, I'm sure that all the other scientists there have mothers. And I'm sure that they all find time after their breakfast or before their count off to pick up a phone and call their mother.
Honey, listen, now you have me on the phone.
And you know how I worry.
Well, that's the point.
I read in the paper that you're still losing them.
Mother. Mother, I don't lose them.
I nearly went out of my mind.
Honey, listen, I want
I thought, what if they're taking it out of his pay?
All right.
Those are two of my favorites, but they are the first improv comedians, to my mind, still the greatest improv comedians.
Why? Why do you think they're the greatest? What was it about their work that was so special?
First of all, they picked material that was risky. And, you know, in today's comedy culture, we're so afraid of offending people. Mike and Elaine, who took on offensive subjects about motherhood and teenage sexuality, they would not be working today if they were in today's comedy culture. So that's one thing. They were unafraid. Two, they were actors, great writers, and great directors. They didn't know that yet, but they had all those muscles working. And that's what great improv comedians need to be, to improvise. A lot of improv comedians, great ones today, they don't have all those muscles working. They may be great actors, but not necessarily great writers. They don't have three out of the three. Mike and Elaine had three out of the three. And I can even add as a fourth, the fearlessness to take on taboo subjects.
Yeah. And Mike Nichols and Elaine May, they were together in terms of doing their act together, what, a few years?
They had their, let's see, it was only a handful of years, but it ended in the early 60s. And then, of course, they went off to tremendous careers in film. Mike obviously directs The Graduate and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, and Elaine directs, you know, A New Leaf, and I think one of the great film comedies of all time, The Heartbreak Kid. Mm-hmm. And, of course, she writes these movies, too, and stars in them.
Yeah, and I want to ask you, sorry to cut you off there, Sam, thing in particular about Elaine May. You spend a fair bit of time in your book talking about Elaine May making this film with Peter Falk and John Cassavetes, Mikey and Nikki, is that what it's called?
Yes,
and then
yes.
She shot it's incredible how she shot so much footage and she like spent, I'll let you talk about it, but she spent hours editing it. My question is, I'm curious, was this because you know, the way her mind worked, and because she had the freedom now to consider all possibilities. Talk a bit about that.
You got it. Well, look, it took a Hollywood that would allow for an improviser to improvise. You know, today that would be unthinkable. It was almost unthinkable even then. I mean, Elaine pushed the studio to the limit. But yes, she working like an improviser, thinking like an improviser, casting two improvisers, John Cassavetes and Peter Falk, virtually improvised her way through this movie, Mikey and Nikki. It's an incredibly intense, funny, surprising movie about a subject we don't really see on screen too often, which is adult male friendship.
Mm.
And Elaine went for it, as she always did. And I think you can see the same high quality in her film Ishtar, which has become a punchline, unfortunately. Though the first half of Ishtar between Dustin Hoffman and Warren Beatty, when they are improvising songs together, is absolutely hilarious.
Yeah. So I might have the timelines wrong, but it doesn't matter. This is improv. It's yes and. We're free-flowing. We're free-form here. I want to ask you, we can't really talk about improv without talking about Del Close, can we? Tell me about him.
No, we can't.
No, tell me about Del Close.
Well, Del Close, who he was a teacher at Second. He was in the Compass, a version of the Compass, which was the first improvisational theater in America, maybe ever in the world, I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Del was in the Compass with Mike and Elaine, and he was then moved on to Second City, and he was part of the Committee, which was a great improvisational theater in San Francisco, and then finally sort of the patron saint of the Upright Citizens Brigade. So Del Close is the Zelig of improvisation and was a teacher and figure of risk. You know, he represents, he had many lessons, but I think Del's great lesson to the world is take the crazy choice, make the crazy choice, because it's only on the other side of crazy that you're going to find new worlds emotionally and artistically. And in a way, he learned that from Elaine. He was in love with Elaine his whole life, and who can blame him? But Elaine used to say, the only safe thing is to take a risk.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great quote, and I wish that's something I could take as my mantra more than I actually do.
I think we all should. Think we all should.
I think you're doing it.
Well, I'm trying to. I'm trying to.
You're succeeding.
I'm glad to hear you say that. I wish we saw more risk taking, you know, in popular culture. It's
Absolutely.
Just become so expensive
that
it's hard to take a risk. And that's one of the reasons I am so excited to go to improv theaters, because there are risks still being taken at your local improv theater. Every night they're taking a risk.
I wanted to get back to Del Close for one second before we move on to some other things. The thing about Del Close, as you talked about, he was creatively restless, and one of his big innovations, like, he kind of got bored with regular improv, short form improv, and then he invented something called the Herald. Can you talk a bit about the Herald?
Yeah, he was one of the inventors of the Herald. The Herald was a sort of a group. A group creation by folks in and around the committee in the mid-60s in San Francisco.
No, art is possible by committee, and at the committee as well. A whole bunch of people can go out and improvise stuff that looks like theater. Basically, all you need is some traffic patterns and some game rules and some kind of image of what it is that you're going to do. And it turned out to be Harold.
Del wanted to take improv out of the realm of short form, which is to say sketch size scenes, you know, the sort of length that you see on Saturday Night Live. And he wanted to make it more theatrical. Can we take this thing and expand it into an evening's entertainment? Can we find a form to help us improvise for an hour? And the Herald was the name they gave this structure, this improvisational structure.
Yeah. Let's fast forward to the 80s, because I want to talk about, I was delighted to see that you talked about at fair length and gave me some insight that I didn't have before into SCTV, one of the greatest, if not the greatest sketch comedy series of all time.
Yeah. Do I hear some Canada in your
yes,
voice?
Yes, you do. That's another reason. My fellow Canadians, with the exception of Harold Ramis, but you know, they were my fellow Canadians. Talk about improv in terms of SCTV.
Well, yeah. I mean, SCTV, this book started for me with SCTV in a way, because even before I started improvising, it just so happens that that my best friend is the son of Andrea Martin and a fellow named Bob Dolman.
Yes.
Andrea was a star of SCTV and Bob was a writer of SCTV. So I grew up watching this work and was obsessed with it. It is the greatest comedy show of all time, and I go into reasons why in the book.
What is so great about it?
Well, aside from the obvious, what puts it over the top for me is that there's actual filmmaking, mm-hmm. that there's satire in the camera work, the lighting, the cutting. This, because SCTV is about media satire and show business satire, that extended into the visual presentation of these sketches. So these sketches were in effect like little movies.
Yes.
And the cultural level of reference on SCTV is also so high. I mean, unbeatably high.
Oh, yeah.
Just think about one of the greatest moments in comedy, Johnny LaRue's Christmas special. I mean, yeah. I don't know if you remember that.
Oh, yes, I do.
When Johnny wants his crane shot and he breaks down. I mean, this is real acting, ladies and gentlemen.
Now tell me honestly, do you think that the Oliviers of this world, the Andy Devines of this world, do you think they had to beg for a crane shot? I think. Therefore, I am not. Can you imagine Wild Bill Hancock and Jingles begging for a crane shot? Well, I had to beg for every crane shot I ever got.
This is real acting. You know, you would see that momentarily in Farley on Saturday Night Live, or Gilda, or Belushi on Saturday Night Live, or Jan Hooks, the great Jan Hooks on Saturday Night Live. These people were really actors, but you got so much of that on SCTV, and that really conveys what we're talking about, this loserdom that's merely just implied, you know, in other forms of comedy.
Yeah, and I guess that's why I relate to it so much, because I feel like I sort of self-identify as a loser and a schmuck, so I can relate to those characters.
Well, we all do. We all should.
Yeah.
We all should, you know. We're all going to lose in the end.
That's right. Very well said. I wanted to ask you, I want to talk about Bill Murray, because Bill Murray to me seems like the spokesmodel of Menefregissimo. Are you familiar with that word?
No.
It's a word that comes from Nick Tosh's biography of Dean Martin, Dino Living High in the Dirty Business of Dreams. And he said that Tosh in that book made the case that Dean Martin was successful because he had this Menefregissimo in terms of the way he did his TV show and just the way he lived his life. Menefregissimo being an Italian word meaning I don't give an F. And it seems to me that Bill Murray has made a career out of that as well. What do you think?
Yes. Simply and resoundingly, yes. And you know, not giving an F is another way of saying the only safe thing is to take a risk.
Yes.
And it's another way of saying be yourself. And it's another way of saying tell the truth. These are all versions of the same thing. And Bill Murray has that.
Mm-hmm.
He can relax. You know, when you see Bill Murray, you're seeing someone who is relaxed. And that's one of the skills that you learn in improvisation. And it's one of the ways that you learn not to give an F is to relax.
Oh, sit down here. Come on. All right.
Where you been? I've been gone for 6 months.
Well, after school, there was a party. And then everybody went to Denver.
Yeah, we're almost out of time, Sam, but one final question, the obvious question, what is the future of improv? How do you see it evolving?
Oh, man. I mean, I see the future of improv as more people doing it,
mm-hmm.
and it becoming more a therapy, mm-hmm. actually. Something that teaches us how to be together. I think the future of improv is not in the theater, actually.
Mm, in real life?
It's in real life. Mm-hmm. It's applying the lessons that we learn on stage to our real life.
Sam Wasson, thank you very much. Yes, and.
Thank you.
Hashtag
thank
yes, you. And.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sam Wasson is the author of Improv Nation, How We Made a Great American Art Form. Find out more about Sam and improv at WPR.com. www.theoutcast.org/beta. That wraps up this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, John Moe, Donna Gaines, and Sam Wasson. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta Podcast via Apple Podcasts or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic!
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
I'd just like to say that I apologize to everyone who ever met me, or knew me, or wanted to meet me.
Our executive producer, nay showrunner, is Adam Friedrich.
You calling me a drunk? I got you this job.
And thanks to you, our alphas. We'll see you next week. Take care and stay safe. I'm Doug Gordon.
Well, some people call him Mr. Relaxation. I thought tonight's show was a little up-tempo, but he's still my favorite entertainer.